next up is Power Players.
Well, thanks for joining us. It's Ken Watmore here with Power Players Radio, and I am so honored and blessed and just excited because I have a really good friend in the studio with me and a brother in Christ, and he's a new friend, my friend Mark Purrington. He and his wife Camille are good new friends of our family, and he's here with Elios Project, and we're going to talk about that today. But I want to just preface this by saying this is an opportunity for you out there to get involved in something that is so big and so necessary, that I really want you to listen into this program. Elios Project right now is about providing clean water, to people really all over the world, but specifically to people in Africa. Mark and Camille have a heart for Africa. They moved there, lived there. We're going to talk about their story a little bit, but I really want you to just sit back and listen in and invite God to work on your heart during this show. So with that, Mark, thanks for joining me in the studio.
Oh, I'm glad to be here, Ken.
It's cool that you're here because we've been talking about this for a while, and the timing is just right, really, because you've got some things coming up here very shortly that are in need of some attention, and they're good. You've been blessed. You have the opportunity next month. We're recording this now in the ending of January 2010, and you have an opportunity to go to Africa next month and drill your first borehole to provide clean water for a village there, or a community. You'll have to correct my dialogue in this. But tell us a little bit about that, and then we'll get into your story a little bit.
Okay, great, Ken. You know, we've been looking at clean water projects around sub-Saharan Africa, Sudan, South Sudan's where we've been working, Kenya. It's a large area. Africa is one of the largest areas that is suffering from clean water. When you look globally at the global water crisis, Africa is one of the hardest hit areas. So clean water is a huge need for clean, safe water, drinking water for people there. And to give you a little information about the project that we're looking at, it's just outside of Nairobi, Kenya, in a small town called Kitengela. This story is pretty amazing because it's a children's home that has six locations in around the Nairobi, Kenya area. Hmm. And the people that run this orphanage, these six orphanages, these children's centers, they're Kenyan, and they're renting this space, and the rent is just killing them. Every month they've got to pay rent, and it's just tough to do. And with as many kids, they have 120 kids in these six locations. They've been able to get the word out, and they've actually raised enough money to buy 6 acres of land and outside of Nairobi and Kitengela, and they want to build a large children's center, their home that will house 120 kids. Mm. And when this facility is built, all the kids from these six centers in around Nairobi will move out there. Well, children need water.
Yeah.
And they're going to start construction, hopefully the end of February is when they hope to break ground and start building some of the housing, dining halls, and they also want to build a school out at the center as well. And one of the things they need for construction is water.
Yeah.
And this is an area where there is no city water. You either have to truck in your water, and that means purchasing it. Water is expensive to buy. If they can have a borehole, and I want to just, some of you probably wondering, they keep saying borehole, what is that? Well, in Africa, a water well is called a borehole, but they need a borehole there, and this will help them with mixing cement and getting some of the building materials put together that they need, and that water will be there when the kids arrive. And that's so important that the kids have clean, safe water.
Hmm. Well, and let's now, I really wanted to jump on that right away because I didn't want to leave it out of this interview. And I want to start, for the first time, I'll mention the website, but we're going to mention it several times throughout. I want everybody to please go to eliosproject.org. That's ELEOSPROGECT.org. And you'll be able to keep up to date with what's going on with them and also on how you can help out and get involved. But it might also define some of the things that we talk about today. Let's go now, having said that, and we're going to come back and wrap the show with the same issue we started with, but let's talk about how you got there first. Mark and I met not too long ago, and it had been on my heart before that you know, God wanted me to be involved in this water initiative somehow. And I won't go too much into that, but I do want to say that right after that had happened, God put Mark in my path through a men's Bible study group. And then after that, we got together with you and Camille, and our families kind of, you know, we're immediately drawn to one another. And since then, God keeps bringing up these water things. And I'm saying that because God did something in me that made me move to this. And now I want to go deeper and deeper. God did something in you to get you involved in Africa several years prior. So lead into that for me. How does it start with Mark Purrington and then get to Elios?
Oh, you bet, Ken. Boy, that's this all began, this journey, about 10 years ago. July of 1999, our church was involved in short-term mission trips. And I had heard about the conflict in South Sudan and persecution of Christians there. And civil war had been ongoing for almost two decades at that time. And God just worked on my heart. I'm not sure what it was. I have to tell you, I wasn't really involved. I was like a lot of people. I just went to church and occupied a seat or a pew, but I wasn't really involved. And God just kind of kept throwing this Sudan issue on my heart. And when our church had the first short-term mission trip to South Sudan in 99, I signed up for that. And I got to tell you, it was a life-changing experience. It just transformed me. I had never been out of the country before. I was going into a conflict, a war zone, basically. And I got to tell you, before that trip, I was a little bit hesitant. I certainly had butterflies. I remember some long conversations with God about, you know, boy, should I really be doing this, God? And I just felt this, you know, his overwhelming presence that this is going to be okay. I want you to go. And I didn't really know why, but I just stayed committed. I tried to be faithful, and we went. And I got to tell you, it was just, again, a life-changing experience going up there. Unbelievable poverty up there and suffering of the people there. I think a lot of people, viewers know or listeners know about Sudan and what's been happening up there. But I came back just a, you know, changed person. And it was at a time where my wife, when I told my wife I was going, I wasn't sure how'd she feel about me going there, because she knew it was a war zone. And she said, "Well, you go and I'll pray for you." So it was pretty amazing that, you know, that she was okay with it. And she said, you know, and she did. She prayed for me every day that I was on that trip. But I remember coming back and, boy, just letting everything that I saw and witnessed there. And, you know, the best part of that trip was just building relationships with people there. It was just incredible. I didn't know how people would accept me there, but so much hospitality there and care for us when we went on the ground, you know, way deep into South Sudan. We saw things. We saw villages that had been burned down. People had been taken, women and children had been taken as slaves from this area. Mm. We heard a lot of stories of this. So it was, again, just a life-changing experience. Coming back, you know, God just worked on me. And as our church started doing more and more with short-term mission trips, they asked me to lead some teams there. And I kind of thought about it. And I said, okay, I think God wants me to go back. And we led some more teams into South Sudan. And every time I came back, I could just feel that God was just working in my heart and saying, "I want you over there full time." And wow, that's a huge, huge commitment.
Oh man,
just huge, just huge.
So you, with that, you at some point you had to come back and tell Camille, "Hey, guess what? I really feel like I'm supposed to live there."
Oh yes, I still remember. It was about 2003, and I realized, you know, okay, in order to go, my wife is gonna want to, you know, is going to be able to be on board with this or feel somewhat comfortable with going. And I really had no idea how she'd feel about this, but we started talking about it and having conversations, and you know, she's just a faithful person and just, you know, loves the Lord. And she could see the transformation in me and said, "You know what, this is God's doing."
Yeah.
You know, and I don't want to, you know, be a block to this. I don't want to be a roadblock to this. And so in 2003, our whole family went to Kenya, And I had the opportunity to go to Sudan with my son and another young man. But my family, my daughter, who at the time I think was 12 at that time, they went to Kenya for a month on a short-term trip. And it was really kind of a vision trip to see, you know, could we live over here and be part of what God is doing there? I knew there was one of two things that could happen. Uh-huh. Either they go and say, there's just no way we can right. do this, or they just fall in love with Africa and the people there. Hmm. And I got to tell you, Ken, it was the second part. They went there. They loved Africa. They loved the people there. And we came back from that trip and said, we're going to start, you know, making that journey. And it takes a lot to get ready to go overseas. We sold our house. We sold all of our belongings just about. And for about a year after we got back, we were just fundraising to go as missionaries to Africa. And it's just an incredible journey where we've been. Our business, we pretty much let our business just, you know, work itself out and wind down. And, you know, in May of 2006, we made that trip with our daughter who was, I think she was 13 at the time. She's going to be a sophomore in high school. And it was, amazing thing is she was excited. My daughter was excited about going. And a lot of kids, that's a... You know, that's hard for them to do, leave their friends and family and school and so, but she was willing to do that.
Well, and I'm just going to back you up for 1 second, because I know it's not something that you would probably normally talk about, but when you say you sold your house, you let your business, you know, kind of go dwindle down and everything like that. It wasn't just that this was kind of your house. I mean, you kind of planned on this being your home to retire in. It was a nice home and in a nice place and everything like that. But you were, I'm only bringing it up because it just shows you were so moved by God, and you guys as a family knew that this was God's directive for you, that you didn't really have a choice, did you?
No, we really didn't, Ken. I got to tell you, when we put our house on the market, the first person that came to look at our house bought it.
Yeah.
And they paid full price.
Wow.
And they paid cash. It was a cash deal.
Amazing.
And they let us live in the house for another almost 4 months until our daughter graduated from school. Wow. And we kept wondering, you know, we figured it would take 3 months. This was back a few years when the real estate market was doing much better than sure. in the Denver area. But it sold in one day. It was just amazing. And, you know, for my wife and I, it was just a confirmation that we did the right thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. So you go to Africa. Kind of maybe paint a picture for our listeners of what that's like when now it's not just a short-term mission trip where you know you're going to be able to turn around in a couple of weeks or a month and fly back home. You're getting off of a plane now and you have everything that you plan on keeping was with you, and you're going to move into a place. How does that process work, and what does it feel like, look like to somebody who has no idea, like me?
You know, Ken, I'll tell you, when we're there in Africa, we just are so dependent on God every day. Hmm. When we're back here in the States, not so much. But there every day, you know, we just we reflect on how dependent we are on God there. Hmm. And luckily we had someone who had a duplex that was recently constructed. It was about 600 square feet. And we were able to move into that, which was incredible for us. And we were there for about 8 months. And so we had housing. I got to tell you, I think between the three of us, when we left here to go to Kenya, we took about 19 bags wow. and a bicycle.
Yeah.
And that's it. All of our belongings was mostly clothes and some books and some computer equipment, you know, a few household items. You can't bring much, you know, on yeah. an airline flight. And some people will bring a whole container or half a container. They'll ship it over there and wait 6 or 8 months before it arrives. We didn't do that. We just really started from scratch when we got there. And it's amazing. Things are there. Grocery stores are much different than they are here. They don't have a Walmart or, you know, Kmart there.
Right. Right, right.
But, you know, you make do and you find, you know, where you can get groceries and where you can get things, and you slowly start getting settled in. We had our place when we initially went for about 8 months, and then had to move to a different place. And God just provided that, you know, just beautifully for us. And we had a place where teams could come, short-term mission teams could come and stay on our property, our compound there in Nairobi. And the compound is just your property. And basically it has, you know, 8-foot-high walls with broken glass on top of the walls so people don't break in, and big steel gate in the driveway when you come in. So everything's just, you know, protected there. And we've been blessed. But that's kind of how it worked out for us, and definitely a transition period going to a new culture. Even though we had spent time in Africa on these short-term trips, when you're finally committed and you're going there and you know you're not coming home for maybe a year, it's a whole different, you know, scenario. And definitely there's a transition period because things are so different, you know, in developing countries. And maybe one day it's the poverty that just, you may be out driving around and you're just seeing some poverty that you can't believe, or maybe you're in the morning, you're reading the newspaper and you hear of the corruption that's going on there, and you're just, you know, why is this happening? You know, why is this happening? And people are suffering because of this corruption.
Yeah, and you're talking about corruption on every level, from the government to the local officiating to even in the humanitarian efforts, there's corruption all the way up.
There really is, and it's just rampant there. It's one of the major problems in Africa today is corruption. And there's a few countries in Africa that are addressing this issue, doing a much better job. Kenya now has an anti-corruption commission now, and people are supposed to report in when they see incidences of corruption going on. But it's been going on for a long time. It's not going to change overnight. And it may take another generation before we see a change there.
Sure. I mean, think of it. Would it be equivalent to something like, you know, the mafia having infiltrated the police departments and having infiltrated the court systems and things like that, to where there's payoff after payoff and for one thing or another? Would that be a good analogy?
I think that would be a pretty good analogy. I don't know all the ins and outs of it, but I'd say that that's a pretty good analogy of what you'll find there. There's a lot of tribalism all over Africa, and that is part of the issues there. In the elections of 2008, when things got so bad in Kenya, a lot of it was just tribal issues.
Right.
And part of that, I think everybody just scrambling to get their, you know, piece of the pie, and you know, not worrying about other people and what's going on.
Yeah. Well, and I just want to touch on one thing that you mentioned too. When you were talking about the duplex, and you and I have talked about this, but for our listeners, the safety issue. You had talked about the walls around the compound, basically, and the broken glass on top, and there's a real need for that kind of thing. And I don't say that to deter anybody from there, but just to recognize what's going on there and what kind of a commitment it takes to be involved, and why it's so important that we help support people like you who have been called and are there and have experienced it, and so that we can keep you going. But there's some safety issues, right? I mean, with your family there, you're in a duplex. What kind of things do you have to deal with?
You know, there's unemployment Kenya is over 50%. Probably, you know, over 50% of the male population is out of work. Hmm. And a lot of these folks, a lot of these are young men. They get out of secondary school or high school, if they can get that far. There's no jobs for them.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're just trying to survive. And so there's a lot of theft and robbery in Nairobi. We have to be real careful driving at night. We try to avoid driving at night. Your compound where you live, you need to make sure it's secure. We have guards 24/7 on our compound.
Wow.
And it's not something that we do here in America.
Right.
But there we have a guard that's, you know, working all night long, just checking things. Lots of lights. One of the dangers is when the electricity goes out in Kenya at night and your lights go out. That's when a lot of people get robbed.
Yeah.
And they have been home invasions, and you just have to be real careful. I know in our compound, when we go to bed, we probably lock up 15 padlocks on gates and doors and things just to be secure at night.
Wow.
So it takes some getting used to. It's different, but you're constantly have to be aware of what's going on around you. Yeah. And carjackings are very prevalent there. And you just have to be really careful, very careful there.
Yeah, and it speaks to the issue of, you talked about how you have to rely on God every day for everything, and it speaks to the issue of security as well. I mean, you're very aware that God has got your back when you're there. And again, I think it's so important that we support people who have been called. And if you feel called to go, he's going to take care of you, and he's going to provide, and he's going to keep you safe. But there are some real things to be aware of there for sure. And just as we're talking, I just want to refer to it again. I'm with Mark Purrington of Elios Project, and I want everyone to go to eliosproject.org, ELEOSproject.org. And we'll keep mentioning that throughout the interview. So let's continue on the story of how your family got there. You're on the ground now, and your original intent to go there was not exactly just clean water, was it? It was more than that.
It sure was, Ken. We originally went there to do community development projects. Up in Sudan, we saw just, you know, huge needs, huge basic human needs: clean water, health, education, and agriculture. And there's other things, economic development. We tried to focus on those four things. And after 3 years of working on the ground, we saw that water is really the key to it all.
Yeah.
And if you're going to be doing community development, a community's got to have clean water. Otherwise, you're always going to have health issues.
Yeah.
And in Africa, the people that go and collect water, the group that collects water every day, and we're talking about, there's no plumbing there. There's no
right.
electricity in these rural areas of Africa. There's no, you know, there's no 7-Eleven around the corner.
Right.
It's very basic stuff, and people have to go out and search for water. And a lot of times it's surface water that's contaminated. It could be a river, a stream, a lake even, areas where heavy rains start collecting and will be around for a while. Well, that same surface water, people bathe in it. Cows will sit in there and do their business in that same water, and it becomes contaminated. In Sudan, they have something called a guinea worm. It's a white worm that starts microscopic when it enters your body, but after a couple of years, it gets up to 3 feet long.
Oh, my goodness.
And Sudan's still an area where this worm is very prevalent. But we started in community development and outreach, and by doing this, we built some credibility within the community, and it allowed us to open some doors and to do things like sharing our faith with people as well.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's pretty hard to go into a community and just start evangelizing without building some credibility and trying to meet some human needs. And Jesus did the same thing. He healed people. He fed people. He did a lot of things before he even preached or evangelized. And so that's what community development has done for us.
Yeah. And then with that, when you recognize that water really is the kind of the caveat to all the other things, you guys really focused in on making the campaign for Elios all about water.
All about water. And we have a new clean water initiative called Never Thirst Again. Mm-hmm. And that name came from John chapter 4, mm-hmm. verses 13 through 14. And, you know, we can physically give people water and it will physically sustain them.
Yeah.
But we want to give them the spiritual water, the living water of Jesus Christ when
yeah.
we go in. And let me tell you, when we go in, we can do a borehole in 5 to 7 days if we have no problems. And the time we're on the ground in a community, it opens up some doors and we can go out, we can show the Jesus film, we can do Bible studies with folks,
yeah.
we can find some folks and grow them and get them started there in their faith. And it's just a wonderful opportunity to do this and just share the living water of Jesus Christ with these folks.
Yeah, and you really are, it provides a key to having the ability to do that with, I mean, what I mean is, you know, when you go there and you're giving people, you know, physically sustaining water, they're going to be open to listen to what you have to say because they're so appreciative that you're actually trying to make a difference in their life and their health, or you're trying to keep them alive, literally. And then they want to hear what you have to say. You've developed a friendship and a trust that they want to hear you. And the key is really, right, they're going to listen to who provides for them. And then they're going to see that Christ really is the one providing for them through you and outfits like you. You know, we want to make sure that we're aware that there's a way to get into these communities, help them sustain life so that we can then share with them Christ and the gospel message of Jesus Christ. So we, you know, it's so important that people recognize the ability and the opportunity that we have by keeping people like you out there doing this kind of thing and getting involved wherever you feel led to, for sure. It's funny, when you came to our house, and we watched the slideshow, which will be available through our website as well. On our website, people will be able to link onto Elios Project, and they'll also be able to watch this slideshow. But when you came over, I remember when my son Logan, who is my 7-year-old, said, "You know, gosh, what do they need?" And Camille said, "You know, well, they need water, and we want to provide that for them." And Logan was just so candid to say, "Well, let's just give them water." And it sounds so simple, but really, that is it, right? Let's just give them water so that we can keep them alive and then share the living water, Jesus Christ, with them. That's what we want some help with to support you guys. So EliosProject.org again. Where are you at right now with this? We talked about it in the beginning of the program with being able to dig your first borehole. When I'm asking this again, I want to get into some more nuts and bolts of it. How much does it cost to do this? What do you really need? Because I know you're contracting out to do this first one, but you really need to get some equipment so that you have the opportunity to go around and do this at your availability, as opposed to waiting for other people and to raise money to do that.
Oh, you're completely correct, Ken. If we had our own equipment, we can drill 2 boreholes for the cost of contracting out for one. That makes a huge, huge impact. The problem in Kenya and most of Africa is that the rig capacity is low, and finding competent contractors to do a good job is a problem. And so those are all issues, that challenges that you're going to have to deal with. And the it's a tough one, you know. And so right now we're looking to raise funds to buy our own drilling equipment, because we know that if we're going to be doing this for, you know, 10, 15, 20 years, we got to have our own equipment, because the cost of contracting out is so expensive. Within just a couple of years of contracting out to do new water wells, mm-hmm. we could buy our own equipment. And
yeah.
Once we have that equipment, then we're not paying that. There's organizations, faith-based organizations and secular organizations, that actually will pay us to drill boreholes for them. Mm-hmm. They're always looking for good people that can use cost-effective methods, and that's something I want to talk about a little bit too. Our methodology is a little bit different than conventional drilling, and that's what makes us different.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And so those things are important. We have short-term strategies and long-term strategies. Some of our short-term strategies are easy to fund, a couple $1,000s, where we do rain harvesting and collecting rain from the rooftops mm-hmm. when there is rain, and that gets put into gutters and then into storage tanks for when there is no rain. Unfortunately, in much of sub-Saharan Africa, there's always drought.
Yeah.
And Kenya right now is experienced, I think this is their third year of drought.
Mm.
There's been a lot of drought in the air, so that means no rains. So sometimes rain harvesting or collecting will work. And even that water needs to be chlorinated or treated. Sometimes you can look at a glass of water and it looks clean, but it may not be safe. It may have some bacteria, things that you can't see with the human eye. And we want to make sure that water is clean, that is clean and safe. And that's why we use both of those terms, clean and safe.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And that water is a short-term strategy where we can chlorinate through chlorine, and we use a little device called a chlorinator.
Uh-huh.
And that will it's very similar to water that's treated in large water treatment systems, just on a much smaller scale.
Mm-hmm.
There's biosand filters that can be used at a household level to try to treat water and make it clean and safe to drink for families. So that's part of some short-term strategies. There's thousands of hand pumps that have been installed all over Africa, and those break down after 2 or 3 years, and people just aren't fixing them. Communities aren't trained. When people go in and drill and they install these hand pumps, they don't train anybody to repair these. And they're not hard to repair. You can do it in a day or two.
Mm-hmm.
And the cost is not bad, $1,500 to $2,000. We can have that pump working again.
Mm-hmm.
Because without that pump, people are now searching for water, and they're going to contaminated water sources.
Right.
Where that water from the borehole is clean and safe for people to drink. So that's part of our short-term strategies as well. long-term strategies is to get our own equipment and to be able to drill these boreholes and bring the cost down. I talked about cost-effective methods, and there's actually some equipment that's in Africa called Pat Drill is the manufacturer that we're going with.
Mm-hmm.
These are smaller, non-conventional rigs. They're on a trailer or mounted on a smaller truck, and these will mobilize into areas most of Africa does not have paved roads.
Right.
And so you're going on unpaved areas, and in the rainy season, it's easy, real easy to get a big rig stuck, a big conventional rig stuck, and now you can't mobilize that rig. Well, we can mobilize that into areas that are harder for conventional equipment to get into.
Okay.
The overall cost of the equipment is about a quarter of the cost of buying a conventional rig. They don't drill as deep. But there's a lot of water in the shallow from surface to about 500 feet, and that's where we want to capture the water.
Mm-hmm.
The deeper you drill, the more expensive things get.
Sure.
And if we can drill a little bit shallower and find good water, which typically there is, you know, we can keep costs down. And we'll do PVC casing instead of steel casing, which is very expensive in Africa. There's all sorts of little things that we do, a methodology and a strategy that makes what we do cost effective. And,
right.
and because of that, we can put in more boreholes.
Yeah, you can get more done.
We can get more done. That's correct.
That's great. So the short-term strategy, take care of the water pumps that are on the ground now, help get some funding in there to fix those, teach people how to fix them, and then the at-home filtration systems, and then the full on filtration system that you would filter rainwater with. So those are all some short-term things. Then long-term, you know, get some money in the kitty so that you can, you know, buy your own gear.
Definitely.
And you said it's a company that's in Africa that you would buy the gear from. So that's sustaining their economy, and it's helping you, and just a great win-win all the way around for sure. But we're talking literally for some of that gear, though, hundreds of thousands of dollars, right?
That's correct, Ken. It gets very expensive. A conventional rig is anywhere from $250,000 to $500,000.
Mm-hmm.
The rig that we're looking at is about $75,000, and then the support equipment, vehicles, and things that you need to do this project,
mm-hmm.
we're about $250,000 for everything.
To get one fully operational rig.
Yes, unit to be able to go out and drill these boreholes for folks. Our ultimate goal is in 5 years to have a total of four of these mm-hmm. units out drilling all over Africa. And right now we're focusing in Kenya in the Maasai Mara area, an area called Kajiado, which is just a drought-stricken area that always has trouble with water. It's on the Kenya-Tanzania border. And then up in Turkana in northern Kenya, there's a very dry area where people are really suffering from lack of clean water and access to clean water. It's just not there.
Yeah.
And you know, there's just a bunch of people. And, you know, we work primarily in rural areas, but there's a lot of people out there. They say that over 15 million people in Kenya do not have access to clean water.
Wow.
And that's a lot of people, just a lot of people. And that's just in one country.
Yeah.
In sub-Saharan Africa, they say there's over 240 million people without access to water. And that's about 46 countries that make up that sub-Saharan Africa area. And globally, we're looking at over a billion people do not have access to clean water today. And that number will continue to grow as populations expand. We are seeing some climate changes, and I think that has an effect on this whole global water crisis.
Mm.
And, you know, we'll be watching that. But there's a lot of factors, and it's not getting any better. People are just not addressing it. I wanted to talk a little bit, too, about the groups that are most affected by this global water crisis.
Yeah, absolutely.
The first group is children.
Yeah.
They just take the brunt of the global water crisis.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason being is that more children die. They say over 6,000 children die every day because of lack of access to clean water and sanitation issues.
Yeah.
Most of those children are under age 5.
Yeah, and you're going to see some of those pictures in the slideshow, too. And I want to point out, when people are looking at this slideshow, there's some pictures that we had looked at before where some kids, their hair is kind kind of reddish orange or something like that. And, you know, originally we thought, well, that's different how their hair's that way. And that's actually a malnutrition issue. Can you talk to that a little bit as you go on? Sorry.
Sure, you bet. One of the things with drinking contaminated water is worms and parasites. Mm. And once you get those in your body, they rob nutrition from you. And so no matter how much you eat, they're just really just, you know, robbing those nutritions, for, especially from children,
yeah.
are the ones that really get hit. And you'll see hair that's turned brown, and that you're correct, Ken. That's a, you know, malnutrition issue. And, you know, some of these numbers we're coming up with that I've stated here are from World Health Organization, WHO, UNICEF has come out with a lot of these figures. And so those are just good numbers to work with.
Yeah. Yeah, and you were talking now this about different people groups that are affected, and you were talking about
kids.
Oh,
yes. Kids are probably the biggest group. Mm-hmm. The second group is women. Mm-hmm. Who collects water in Africa in the family? It's usually women and girls. And sometimes if there's no girls in the family, the young boys will be, this will be part of their chores every day. You know, it's not, you just cannot turn on a tap or a faucet there.
Yeah.
Sometimes you've got to walk 4 miles a day.
Wow.
You know, 4 miles each way to a water point, a place where there's water, whether it's a borehole or it's a river or a stream or lake or something where you can get some water. And Ken, you have to drink water. You can't go more than a few days without water. You can go a month without food, but you cannot go. Our bodies, God just didn't design us to go more than a few days without water. So you have to drink whatever water you can find. Well, I want to get back to women. Women have a huge issue. They spend hours and hours and hours every day. This is a daily ritual. They get up in the morning and, you know, get their families ready, and then they've got to go in search of water. And many other women in a community and villages are doing the same thing. And it's just a huge burden on women every day. And then they carry 5 gallon jerry cans, water containers on their heads, on their backs. You know, 4 miles a day, that's huge.
Yeah.
Just huge. The next group, and now I'm going to shift to another area, and that's education. We haven't talked a lot about education, but when kids are put into that system of getting water every day, and it's part of their chores, they don't get to go to school.
Yeah, no time.
There's no time to go to school, Ken. And that's something that we want to change. And one of the places we want to drill new boreholes is at schools.
Oh,
because then kids can bring the jerry cans to school, attend school, and when school is out, fill up the jerry cans, take them home, and then do it again the next day.
What a great idea.
Yeah. And we've targeted churches because we want to give God the glory for water.
Yes.
It gives an opportunity for pastors at these churches when they have a borehole on the church property to reach out to people.
Yeah,
and
great.
So it's a great opportunity. We want to drill at schools because, again, we want kids to be able to get an education. And girls, probably girls that are in school are the most affected by this.
Mm-hmm.
And they just don't get an education. Want to be able to drill at orphanages, and like the one that we talked about when we started the show here, the Bridges Orphanage in Kitengela. Because a lot of orphanages have to buy water when they have the funds to do that. Buying water is very expensive.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, if we can get them water, then they can save that money, buy food, buy medicine, buy blankets, things that, you know, kids really need, orphans really need.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's just it would change things. We've had some orphanages where they get a borehole in, they have plenty of water for the orphanage, and now they're selling some water, and that income actually helps them to do other things like buy medicine and buy food and clothes and things like that. So that's an opportunity. And then, of course, clinics and hospitals. And that's a great place because health is another area that's affected by the global water crisis. When you don't have, you know, clean, safe water to drink, you're going to get sick. And there's a lot of diseases that are waterborne type diseases, cholera, typhoid, dysentery. There's a huge, huge list of waterborne diseases and effects out there. And some of these are, they will kill you. Some of these diseases, if you don't get treated, they will kill you.
Yeah. Wow. Well, I mean, that sounds like such a great strategy to put it right in the places where it's needed and it's the most effective to bring people to them. And I love the idea of putting it at a church where, you know, a pastor is to be able to use that to bring people there and be able to share Christ with them, to put it in schools where kids have the opportunity to go to school and then still bring water home. I mean, it just sounds so good. And the thing that we can do is it's going to happen if we help. It's going to happen if we help. So again, I want people to go to eliosproject.org. I want to, you know, get involved if God's moving you to do so. If you feel even a little tug, pray about it and see how you can be involved to help out. Any other ways that people can help out, Mark, or any other things that you want to address before we end the show today?
Yeah, I just want to, you know, even a dollar can make a difference.
Yeah.
As far as water goes, people think, well, I can't, and you know, I can't give a lot of money. We figured out $1 can give water to 14 people.
Wow.
Safe water for 14 people. Just $1.
Yeah.
And if you multiply that, we can make a big difference. A donation of $25 will provide clean, safe water for one person for 10 to 20 years from a borehole that we drill using our cost-effective methods.
Wow.
That's huge. That makes a huge difference.
Yeah.
A huge difference.
Well, and I'm not one who ever does this, but I mean, really, as I'm sitting here thinking about it, I'm thinking, you know, when I go to get gas, you know, and I run in the store and get a Coke, you know, or something like that. I mean, just one less Coke, right, is some water for 10 or 14 people. And, I mean, it's just when you start to add that up and say, okay, how many times do I get gas? How many Cokes is that? I mean, you could, I mean, 20, 25 bucks, what, anything you can do really is needed. And I, you know, for the people that are listening, you know, a lot of people do think, well, gosh, how do I know my money goes there? And, how do I, you're here. It's tangible. You're right here in the studio with me. We're not sending to some place where we don't know where it's going. I mean, we know exactly where it's going. And, I would just invite people, encourage them to research Elios Project if you want. Dig in, you know, but most importantly and most effectively, pray about it. And God will reveal to you that this is a worthy organization, a worthy cause. And it's, you know, water is the basis, I would say, second to only one thing, and that's Christ himself. You know, without Christ, we're dead spiritually. We might as well be dead physically. And without water, we can just take the second part of that and go ahead. Physically, we can't live without water, and we can't live at all without our Lord and Savior Christ. And he's given you guys an opportunity to really make a difference in the world, starting out with this project in Africa. So I'm so grateful to have you here and as my friend. And I just, I want everybody to do anything they feel led to do to help out Elios Project. So thank you so much.
Thank you for having me here today, Ken. I really appreciate it. And we appreciate your listeners out there. And, you know, we're just here to you know, help any way we can. We need your prayers. That's one thing that we can use from, that we really need from your audience, is just pray for us. Pray for people in Africa. You know, so many people are suffering from so many things there. It's just hard to describe. Water is just a small part of it all. It's a part that we're focusing on and getting involved with. But there's just a lot of things. And Africa needs your prayers. It really does. And
yeah.
We know that there's other places in the world that are suffering as well. And they need prayer just as much. So, you know, just keep us in your prayers. And mostly we need you to raise awareness, you know, your audience to raise awareness about this. Go and talk to your, you know, your neighbors, your friends, your families, your schools about this. And we'd be happy to come and speak to a school or an organization, a church, to come, you know, raise awareness about the global water crisis so people mm-hmm. know more about it and can find out how they can get involved and help. And we're willing to do that. We'll have a place on our website we can actually click on there and, you know, request that someone come and speak. And we would love to do that. Part of our job is just raising awareness about this global water crisis.
Yeah. And I can't emphasize enough this. You know, we're here, we're talking about Elios Project, and I keep referring to, if God's moving you, I would venture to go a little further with that and say this. If this isn't where God's moving you, he's going to move you somewhere. And you got to dig in to find out what that is. You've got to ask him to move you. And, you know, when he does, you got to act on it. And maybe it's not Elio's project. Maybe it's Haiti. Right now, Haiti is in tremendous, one of the worst disasters of all time. Maybe the worst we've seen in this hemisphere, certainly. But maybe it's Haiti that you're being moved to. Maybe it's Africa. Maybe it's another country. But if God is moving you, one small action, not just financially, but just whatever it is, to get involved. Like, Mark, you were called to do a short-term mission trip in Africa. Here we are 10 years, 11 years later, and you're actually going to be able to take part and be blessed yourself to be able to provide water that sustains life physically there and then share Christ with people who would never otherwise have heard the gospel. You know, this is an amazing thing. So one action leads to what God has really planned for you. And I would just encourage anybody, whether it's this or something else, cry out to God, ask him to reveal to you what that is, and then you got to move on it. And if you don't, look at what you could be leaving on the table. So thanks again for coming in. Thanks for our listeners out there for listening. And we just want to encourage you to get involved.
Thank you, Ken. Thanks for having us here today.
Absolutely. Thank you.